It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If your garden is busting with tomatoes and you're not sure what to do with all of them, you'll want to stick around for advice on turning those tomatoes into fresh and healthy salsas. That's coming up on our Food Friday.
But first, it's back to school season, and while parents and students are stocking up on school supplies, educators and administrators are starting to think about how they'll adjust to a new set of school standards known as Common Core.
It's a program that sets new and rigorous goals for students at each grade level, and it's starting to attract some opposition from critics.
Here to talk about it with us is Nora Hertel. She is a reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. The center collaborates with Wisconsin Public Radio. Her new report on Common Core is going to be released on Sunday morning on wisconsinwatch.org, and it'll also be published in several newspapers around Wisconsin. Nora, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
First, let's start out by getting a basic definition of Common Core. We've been hearing a lot about it lately, and it's just sort of referenced. You know, people are for the Common Core or they're against it. So what is it?
Yeah, well, it's a set of standards that was developed in 2009 by the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers. And the goal was to kind of establish college and career ready standards for students across all of the states.
Okay.
45 states have adopted them, Wisconsin included, and they are different from the standards we have now because right now, or I should say the previous standards that we had, cover 4th, 8th, and 12th grade. The Common Core standards cover kindergarten through 12th grade. And a lot of people would say that they go much more in depth. They require more analysis of students.
So when you say that they cover K through 12 as opposed to 4, 8, and 12, that means that the examinations are taken currently in 4th grade, 8th grade, and 12th grade? Or why did you make that distinction between K-12 and 4, 8, and 12?
Well, the standards that were written before, they only say what students need to know by fourth grade, by 8th grade, and by 12th grade. And there will actually be more testing in 2014, and those tests will align with the Common Core.
So we've been hearing a lot about Common Core, particularly in the last few months as part of the budget process here in Wisconsin. And the question I have is, you mentioned that the work on this started back in 2009. It's been floating out there for a while. Why has we been hearing so much about it lately? Where is this opposition? Where are these questions coming from?
Yeah, well, the opposition arose about 7 months ago. At least that's how the DPI, the Department of Instruction, has described it to me. They were adopted in Wisconsin in 2010, and there wasn't too much opposition at the time. But about 7 months ago, Tea Party groups in the state and actually across the country started rallying together, addressing this as a federal overreach. Another reason that this is coming up now is because those tests in Wisconsin are coming in 2014, and those changes are evident in the classroom this year. Some have been evident in the last year or so, but this is the year that most schools that are going to be testing to those standards really need to be having them in place.
To start dealing with them and to start actually seeing them turn up in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were adopted in Wisconsin, how did that process work? Who adopted the standards?
Tony Evers. And since we don't have a state board of education, he has the sole authority to make that decision.
And so since they've already been adopted, what are the opponents of Common Core hoping to do? Are they hoping to slow the process down? Are they hoping to stop it? What are they looking for?
Yeah, well, when the Joint Finance Committee met, they decided they wanted to put the standards on pause. But really what that did was it just kept future standards from being adopted without a more rigorous review. There was language in the budget that also called for a review of the standards that were adopted, math and English. That review may or may not happen. The Legislative Council is still deciding if they are going to do that review, but there's a Fiscal Bureau review that's due out a week from today. So we'll have that information, and then the Department of Public Instruction is conducting a study, and then they plan to have several hearings this fall once all of that is released.
So we've talked a little bit about who is opposing the Common Core standards. Who is supporting Common Core in Wisconsin?
I talked to several administrators that are really behind it. Obviously, the Department of Public Instruction is a big fan of the standards. They've been working on implementation for the last couple years. I've noticed even the people that are a fan of the standards, administrators, department chairs, they recognize that it's a really big change, that it requires new materials, it requires professional development for teachers, and that it's going to be hard for everyone. But they think that it's worth the effort, that the standards we had before weren't sufficient, and that this is going to be good for Wisconsin.
So what happens next? You mentioned that Fiscal Bureau report is expected to come out a week or so from now. So somebody is going to get the results of this in the legislature, and then what?
Yeah, well, I asked some of the opponents what they want from this, and a few, I talked to a homeschooler in Green Bay. She used to be a teacher, and she would be happy to see us go back to the old standards, at least temporarily. The Department of Public Instruction was in the process of rewriting our own standards in 2007, and then Common Core came around, and we decided to go with what they were developing. It made it a little easier.
So now, earlier you said that the Common Core implementation has been put on pause. But as I look at my calendar right now, it's August and school is scheduled to start next couple of weeks. So where does that leave Wisconsin schools right now in terms of standards in place?
Yeah, the pause term is kind of misleading, actually, because if you look at the budget language, it basically says that we can't go forward with other standards that haven't already been adopted. So we adopted math and English, and those are going forward. What the budget specifies is that we couldn't, for instance, take science or social studies standards without a more rigorous legislative review.
So basically, we've adopted some of the standards, but not all of them, and some of them will go into effect?
Well, there are no science or social studies standards. So, it's been kind of confusing as far as the way the wording in the budget. But for all intents and purposes, we're going forward with the math and the English. And if something comes out in the fiscal report or the legislative council uncovers something and there's a big enough backlash, then the state can choose other college and career-ready standards, but they have to do that by next July. So would they have time to get it together by then? I'm not sure.
And where are key legislators on this? For example, where's Governor Walker's office on this?
Governor Walker was a supporter of the standards early on, and he did not return a request for comment this past week. He recently made a statement that was published in a different article that was pretty vague. He said high standards are important. It's important to get parent feedback, but he didn't really say these are great or these are terrible or we should move forward or we should move backward.
One of the things we've talked about, we've been focusing on Wisconsin a lot, but there are similar discussions happening around the country, right?
Yeah. There's been a lot of coverage of what's been going on in Michigan and Indiana. Indiana has put really similar language in a law, similar to what we put in the budget. Their opposition seems to be more vocal. They're doing a review of the standards. They put them on pause, similar to what we did. In Michigan, they defunded the standards in their last budget. In Wisconsin, we haven't, or the Department of Public Instruction says that we haven't put any additional state funds towards the standards. So it's been clear to me that individual districts have been spending extra money on this, rearranging funds as well.
And I hate to put you on the spot and make you make a prediction, but I'm going to ask you to make a prediction. So what do you think is going to happen with Common Core ultimately, or is it too early to tell?
My sense in Wisconsin is that this is not my quote. This is one of the superintendents who spoke at the hearing on May 22nd, is that this is a moving train. You know, they've been doing this since 2010. It's in curriculum. A lot of schools have already bought new materials. It would be really expensive, I suspect, to rewind on this. And I suspect that the Legislative Fiscal Bureau will report that next Friday. They are going to be reporting how much it costs the state to do the implementation and how much it would cost to rewind on it.
And we'll see where it goes from there. Nora, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Nora Hurdle is a reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, which partners with Wisconsin Public Radio. Her new report on Common Core is going to be released on Sunday morning on wisconsinwatch.org. You can find it there. It'll also be published in several newspapers around the state.
Coming up, learn how to turn your bumper crop of tomatoes into a pantry's worth of fresh salsa. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Jean Purcell. You're listening to Central Time.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Jean Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We are in the thick of tomato season here in Wisconsin. Backyard gardens, farmers markets are overflowing with heirloom tomatoes, sun golds, purple Cherokees, every kind of tomato you can imagine.
Yeah, so how's your tomato doing?
My single tomato plant you're referring to?
That's the
one.
You
know what, Jean? It is thriving. Thank you very much. I care for it.
Well, at the Purcell house, we've got about a dozen tomato plants right now, and they're like little trees. Mm. And we have, I would say, hundreds of tomatoes. And it does beg the question, what are we going to do with all of these? The obvious answer is canning, but we've got another solution today for you from Anna Thomas Bates, and that answer is salsa. Anna is a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com, and she writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section. Anna Thomas Bates, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Anna, tell us why you think this is such a great time for homemade salsa.
Well, in my opinion, if it's not a local tomato, it's not a good tomato. And right now, the tomatoes here in Wisconsin are at their peak of juiciness and lushness. And if you're going to have a fresh salsa, now is absolutely the time to do it. Jean, I hope you'll share with Veronica.
I'll be happy to do that.
I hope you will, too, actually.
Yeah, well, maybe if she's nice, we'll see.
I have to say, does it bug you, Anna, when you go to a restaurant right now and you get a tomato on your sandwich and it's albino? You know, it's white. It's not a real tomato in many ways.
There's really no excuse for it, is there? There's too many good tomatoes here.
Well, what are all the varieties that are out there? Can you run down some of them and tell us which ones lend themselves best to salsa?
Sure. Well, whatever tomato you like the taste of best. You know, you mentioned the purple Cherokees. I love the Brandywines. Nebraska Wedding is a really bright orange tomato. I really like the big, juicy slicing tomatoes for salsa. I know some people like to use the Italian paste aroma tomatoes because they're meatier and they think it will make a less watery salsa, but I disagree. I would much rather use a juicy tomato, chop them up, salt them, and then put them in a fine mesh sieve over a bowl, let them drain for 30 minutes so you still get all the flavor of that great heirloom tomato, but you don't have a watery salsa.
Mm. Do you mind it when your salsa gets a little soupy?
Well, no, you just use more chips.
I like that. So tell us about Salsa 101. What is sort of your basic salsa recipe?
Sure. A basic fresh salsa recipe, you're going to have really good tomatoes, a little bit of onion, typically a white onion, some garlic maybe, cilantro maybe, and then the other two key ingredients that you cannot forget is you need an acid, a lime juice, a lemon juice, or a vinegar, and salt. And it's really that acid and that salt that's really going to make the flavors of your vegetables sing.
Are you partial to the lime or the lemon?
I usually go for the lime. It just feels a little bit more summery to me. But in my guacamole, I like to use lemon juice.
Interesting. Okay. So what about a food processor? Is it okay to just kind of mash it up, cut it up yourself, and let it do what it's going to do? Or do you like it to be kind of finely ground?
You know, it depends on what you're going for. If you want kind of a fresh, chunky, more like a pico de gallo that you're really going to scoop up with a chip, I just dice it all by hand. If you want more that restaurant style that's, you know, a lot more liquidy, that's really good for enchiladas or with eggs, then a food processor is nice. But it's definitely not a requirement to enjoy some good summer salsa.
What are some ways that we can kind of punch up our salsa, make it a little more interesting than your, you know, sort of usual pico de gallo?
Sure. There's a couple different ways. One is with some surprising ingredients. You can throw in a little bit of crisp, cool cucumber in there for some added crunch. Sweet corn would be another great addition this time of year. And you can also throw in some local fruit, you know, a little bit of watermelon, some cantaloupe, you know, especially mixed with that cucumber would make an interesting salsa. And right now I'm kind of coming up with a recipe for a ripe peach green tomato jalapeno salsa.
So oh, wow. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, keep an eye on my blog for that one. I'm hoping to get it up this weekend. And the other way you can keep things interesting is with your technique. You could roast the vegetables first. You could toss them on a grill, which would just add a little bit of smokiness and some of that real good charred flavor.
So you mentioned sweet corn. For something like that, is it okay to just slice the corn off the cob into the salsa, or do you want to cook it first?
You know, it's so good this time of year. You can really easily get away without cooking it. You can just slice it off the cob and toss it in there. And with that tomato juice and that acid, it's all going to taste really good.
Now, tomatillos are another popular ingredient in salsas, and they're fun to cook with. I've cooked with them before and made salsas. We've always roasted them. How do you use tomatillos?
You know, I'm partial to roasting and grilling as well. They're a little bit of a different texture, and I just really think they get a little bit brighter and just a little bit softer and a little bit more palatable with just a little bit of cooking on them. You know, if I really want that kind of green, bright taste, I actually just throw in some green tomatoes.
Oh, green tomatoes. Do you think they're as good for you, green tomatoes, as when they get red and ripe and juicy?
Say that again?
Do you think they're as nutritious, green tomatoes?
Well, they're not going to have that lycopene in there, but, you know, we've got so many red tomatoes, and then we're left with all those sad green tomatoes at the very end when the frost is impending, so we might as well use them, too. They need homes as well.
So when you're making your salsas, do you can them so that and kind of preserve them, or do you just basically make them and eat them?
I do more fresh salsa. I usually save my canning. I'll just do straight up tomatoes or spaghetti sauce. You certainly can it, although I would encourage everyone to look for a tested recipe that definitely has the right amount of acid in it so that you know that it's safe to can. If you get too many onions and peppers in there, the levels of acid aren't quite right, and you could get in trouble with canning.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're cooking it as well, so it's not going to have quite the bright, fresh flavors that you will have in a salsa that you just make and enjoy.
Now, earlier this summer, we had on one of our resident WPR foodies, Lori Skelton, and she had made a strawberry salsa, which was really interesting. And I wonder if you have any more tips for including fruit. It seems kind of counterintuitive, but what does fruit do when you add it to a salsa?
Well, if you think about it, you know, the difference between a tomato and a strawberry or a tomato and a peach, they're not that far off. You know, in our heads, they're very fruits and vegetables, or at least they're categorized that way. But they're sweet. They kind of have a little bit of an exotic, almost musky flavor, which is not far off from a good peach or a cherry or a plum. So, you know, I say go ahead and experiment. You see lots of fruits and savory dishes, and this is no different. You know, a peach and an onion or a mango and an onion with some cilantro and lime juice, maybe even throw some creamy avocado in there, and you're going to have something really delicious.
So in terms of this fruit, can you make a fruit salsa that is good with a chip, or do you have to put it on something like a pork chop to really make it shine? Is it just going to be, you know, is it going to lend itself to chips?
I think so. You know, if you've got a nice limey margarita and some salty chips, you know, if you have a pineapple, or, you know, think about honeydew and cucumber and jalapeno and onion. I think the onion and the jalapeno make it savory enough that it's still going to go really well with that chip, but with that added brightness from the fruit.
That sounds good. And so for those leftover tomatoes, now it would be lovely if we could turn it all into salsa. This sounds so delicious. But if you can't and you've got these leftover tomatoes, what do you recommend we do with them?
Oh, well, my favorite way of preserving, if you have enough room in the freezer, is to do a nice slow roast with a little bit of salt, a little bit of thyme and oregano, toss them with olive oil, quarter up the medium-sized ones, slice in half the tiny ones, and just roast them in a low oven for a couple hours till they get really nice and just start to shrivel a little bit, and you can slide all that into a big freezer bag and freeze it flat and just stack them up, and you can use them all year long in pasta sauce, bruschetta, all sorts of delicious things.
Really? So you roast them for a couple hours. What temperature?
I usually go about 200, 225.
And just on a pan, like an ungreased baking pan.
Yeah, if you want to ease the cleanup a little bit, you can line it with parchment or one of those silicone liners. They do get a little sticky, but it just concentrates the flavor, brings on a little bit of sweetness, and they're really delicious.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. Well, Anna, thank you so much for all the great ideas.
Thank you. Have a great summer.
Thanks. We've been talking to Anna Thomas Bates. She's a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. And coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk about the upcoming 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
We'll also be talking with a young woman who lost both her son and her husband within a 20-month period. That experience inspired her to write about her journey in Creative Grieving, A Hip Chick's Path from Loss to Hope.
That's coming up Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a guest who says people with depression need to open up and talk about what it's like to live with the condition. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Some experts say that depression has become an epidemic in the United States.
According to the National Institute of Mental Health, about 20 million adults in the U.S. have a mood disorder. That's about 10% of the adult population.
Our next guest says one of the most difficult parts of depression is that we're not very open about it.
Jonathan Rottenberg is a research psychologist at the University of South Florida. And he's trying to encourage people to share their experiences with depression. He recently started an online video series called Let's Take Back Our National Conversation About Depression. Jonathan Rottenberg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start out with some of the real basics here. And one of the real basic questions I have is, depression is a term that gets bandied about an awful lot. And how do you define it?
Well, depression is a mood condition. When we talk about clinical depression, it involves a variety of changes. So people feel sad, they lose interest in things, they have trouble concentrating, they experience changes in their appetite, usually eating less, and in their sleep, usually sleeping less. And then they have profound changes in how they see themselves. So typically they have very, very low self-worth, and also include some dangerous symptoms like being suicidal.
And of course, you know, people get happy and sad in the course of everyday life, but this is something that's beyond the normal ebbs and flows.
Well, depression comes in many shades, just as moods come in many shades. But when we talk about the global problem of depression, and it is a problem not only in the U.S., but across the world, the World Health Organization says it is going to become the most burdensome disease by 2030. We're talking about a relatively serious mood condition. And when you bring it down to the street level and bring it down to what's going on in Wisconsin, for example, whether it's a big city like Milwaukee or a small town like Cleveland, and you start walking down the street, you only have to go about five or six houses before you're going to find someone who's bearing depression's burden. And I teach a course at the University of South Florida, and I ask how many of you have either experienced depression or have seen it in a friend or a family member, and 7 out of 10 people will raise their hands. So this is very personal, and I was really struck by this huge problem, global problem, that comes down to people that we know, and yet the quality and the quantity of our conversation about depression really leave a lot to be desired.
And what are the implications of not talking about it, of not having those conversations?
The implications are that people will delay getting help. To give you one example, in the military, there are over 900 programs designed to prevent suicide, and yet 350 active duty troops killed themselves last year. And it was not only because of mental health concerns like depression. It was because the troops are embarrassed about having a mental health problem. They're embarrassed about seeking help for a mental health problem. So they keep it to themselves, and they don't get help. And this is delaying people's treatment, and stigma can even, it can even kill.
Now, you've started this online video series to try to launch that national conversation. Why have this conversation in this particular forum? Is it just that the technology is available and it's a great way to reach people, or what? Why did you choose this path?
Well, I had been blogging, so I had been part of this sort of social media, but I wanted to do something more direct and more interactive. Blogging, you will write stories and people will read them, but I think in order to really open up this conversation, we really need participation among different groups of people. So people who experience depression, people who experience depression in the past and are now doing clinically well, and the caregivers, the family and friends who care for people about depression. And in my experience, these groups of people don't really talk to one another, even though they have a huge amount of experience that they could be sharing with one another. And it seemed to me that social media potentially had an immense potential to, you know, kind of open up this conversation. And so in addition to the YouTube videos that you referred to, I'm also using Facebook. And, you know, on that page, I'm really emphasizing the importance of stories and actually talking about depression. And because it is difficult to talk about, I'm trying to sort of model how we go about talking about depression. I'm even talking about my own experiences with depression as a way of even explaining how difficult it is, because I found it very difficult to talk about my own depression.
Yeah, I mean, you've got that professional aspect, but then that personal experience as well. And let's explore that a little bit, because one of the issues I know that you've worked with or studied or struggled with is that whole issue of the stigma that goes along with depression that you know, in turn makes it difficult for people to talk about, to admit that there's an issue.
That's exactly right. I mean, unfortunately, our national conversation about depression is, I mean, it's a little bit unfair, but you could summarize it as to Prozac or not Prozac. You know, there's a long history of thinking about depression in terms of what is wrong with the depressed person. In the olden days, it was that the depressed person lacked the will to get better. There was something wrong with their character. And in more recent times, it's really an emphasis on what might be wrong with the depressed person's brain or their genes. But there's some fault. There's some way in which depressed people are faulty. And I think that even though many of us is well-intentioned, it really reinforces the idea that depressed people shouldn't feel comfortable talking about their depression, because fundamentally there's something wrong with them, and it's not okay to have depression. And that very much was the case in my own experience when I experienced depression in 1993. I had no idea what it was. I was very ill-educated about depression, what was happening to me, and I was terribly ashamed and frightened. And I very much kept it to myself, told very few people, and it went on for years, just in that way. I really, unfortunately, think that that continues. Even 20 years later, I'm doing fine, but I see people who are struggling in the same way with the same issues.
And it's interesting that in those 20 years, despite all the—I want to talk a little bit about medication for a second here, but despite all the medications we see advertisements for, there seems to be talk about depression sort of at that level. You know, we've got this medication, this pill that's going to make you better,
right,
but it seems as though we're having a hard time getting beyond that sort of treating the symptoms as opposed to getting to the root cause.
I think that's exactly right. And my perspective in my research is to understand depression as a mood state. And if you think about depression as a mood state, then you would have a somewhat broader view, I think, than simply looking at medications or tweaking one neurotransmitter in the brain, because what you would be thinking about are, what are all the things that can push around mood? And there are actually a large number of things, from the routine that you have, the amount of sleep that you get, the amount of light that you get, sunlight that you get, to events that are going on in your life, your relationships, your goals, and yes, your biology plays some role as well, for example, your temperament, but it's a much broader view. And so this means that there are a lot of ways potentially to get into depression, and more positively, there are also a number of ways to get out of depression, and medications would be one way only, to try to reduce the symptoms. And I'm not speaking against medications, that people shouldn't try medications, but I encourage people to take a broader perspective on mood.
Yeah, it seems as though, you know, when you were talking about that list of why people get depressed or why they might get depressed, there's all sorts of things there, but that issue of how people work out of depression seems as though it's a lot more mysterious.
It is, and it is from a scientific standpoint. And actually, that's the kinds of stories that I very much want to see on my Facebook page, in part because I know that there's a hunger for positive news, and there's not a good understanding about how people recover. I think that there are probably a number of routes out of depression, and again, that's a good thing. But, you know, for depressed people, one of the really profound things is the sense of hopelessness, that my depression will never get better. And that's where I think formerly depressed people have an incredibly powerful role that they can play. But now in our mental health system, if you have depression, generally speaking, you go to a mental health professional, and that's great. But the testimony and the experiences of people who have been through depression and are now on the other side is incredibly powerful and I think very underutilized.
We're talking with Jonathan Rottenberg, a research psychologist at the University of South Florida. He started an online video series, Let's Take Back Our National Conversation About Depression, and we're using that series as kind of a springboard for our discussion here. We'd like to hear from you, too. Have you experienced depression? Have you recovered from depression? And how did you do that? Was it medication? Was it something else? And what advice might you have for others who are suffering from depression? It's a widespread issue. We've been talking about that. It probably affects you or perhaps somebody you know in your family or a close friend. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or drop us an email at talk@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking with Jonathan Rottenberg this half hour, research psychologist at the University of South Florida. He started an online video series, Let's Take Back Our National Conversation About Depression. And by the way, we'll be posting a link to his Facebook page and those videos on our Central Time Facebook page. So if you'd like to check these out, you can just go to Facebook and look for the Central Time page, and you will find it there. Lots of callers would like to get in on this discussion, and we begin with Janet, who joins us from Wausau. Hi, Janet.
Hi.
How are you today?
Pretty good today.
Well, good. Let's talk about it.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to start off by saying that I will be 43 years old in September. And I've suffered from depression as long as I can remember, being a small child, and started being treated for depression when I was a teenager, probably around age 16, 17. I was sent to a psychologist and psychiatrist and was prescribed medication. So I've been on and off medication since then, mostly on. I've had some periods that I've tried without medication and tend to not do very well, but I'm not an advocate of medication, so that's kind of weird for me. So
if I could ask, Janet, are you able to have these conversations about depression? I mean, how widely known is it among your circle of family and friends?
It's pretty well known in my family because they've had to, you know, deal with the consequences of my depression. It's not really understood by them or necessarily, you know, they're not sort of necessarily the most supportive because they don't understand it, but they, you know, they're aware of it. And my, you know, some of my friends are aware of it. I would say that people I work with, you know, and that sort of thing are not aware of it. And actually, if you met me, you would never probably have depression.
All right. Very good. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Amazing thing that you can have something so profound that shapes how you think, how you feel, and your feelings that are inside can be so mismatched to the outside front that you're presenting to the world. I mean, I think that is part of the burden of having depression in an environment where depression really isn't well understood. I mean, I think Janet's story is profound in the sense that it is it's so hard to hear that someone has this very great weight that they're walking around in the world with that very few people know. Very few people, for example, at her work know just how significant a problem is. And that makes it a double burden. So on the one, we have the symptoms, and you have the weight of having the symptoms but being unable to say what's going on with you.
Yeah, and she also mentioned, her family having trouble knowing about it, but having sort of trouble understanding it and being supportive. And there is that burden, too, that
yes.
family and friends bear at the same time. You know, that it's hard.
It's very hard. I mean, let me give you a contrast. So if you or your family member tell other people that you're in the hospital, and you're in the hospital for a heart attack, or in the hospital because you had a spinal injury after an accident, other people say, how can I help? Can I bring over a casserole? What can I do? If the person said that you're in the hospital for depression, and that's a big if, how will people respond? People don't know what to say. People don't know what to do. Depression still is this kind of taboo, frightening topic. And I think the first stage, I mean, we're learning how to talk about it, is absolutely necessary.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Kim is with us from Madison. Hi, Kim.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
Taking the call?
Yep.
I too have had severe depression my whole life, and it got till about a year ago, just increasing chemical brain soup, different combinations. And I felt like I was just floating on a chemical brain soup. And then I've always had kind of a spiritual inquisitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I couldn't let the depression get any worse, so that was something I was going to look at, because, you know, their rule is spiritualists is do unto others as you'd have them do unto you.
Mm-hmm.
And just following and accepting some of the principles, which really make a lot of sense. And God, I don't know, I really had a problem with the white God on the golden throne. and just following something that felt truer to me has really, really helped my depression.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel bad if somebody that was really feeling black right now, like I've known, to hear this and get really discouraged, but I wish that they'd just maybe take it into consideration, because it does work.
All right. Mm-hmm. Kim, thanks so much for the call. Jonathan Rottenberg, hearing Kim's story there, that idea of having something else to sort of be an anchor, is that important in all of this?
It's critical. I mean, whether it's a caregiver is your lifeline. Kim talked about religion. So one of my criticisms of the disease model, the idea that you're just a bunch of neurotransmitters, or she said the phrase chemical soup, is that depression essentially is totally meaningless. And if it's totally meaningless, then there's nothing to talk about. And then you're just waiting for the medication to kick in. And, you know, that's just not how humans operate. So that's another reason why I think it is useful to try to talk to others about it.
Chris is with us now from Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I got a old business adage is feelings follow action. And just a couple weeks ago, I heard on this very station, on the People's Pharmacy, how exercise has been shown to be more effective than medication in mild to moderate depression. And I really think that this is a luxurious society that we have the affordability of worrying about how we feel instead of where our next meal comes from. So a lot of times people need to just decide to get up and do something, and they will feel better. I've seen that in several people's lives. Feelings follow action.
Chris, thanks for the call. Jonathan Rottenberg, I got to tell you, Chris makes it sound easy.
It's not easy, but I agree with him to the extent that people who have depression they can't be passive. They can't wait for the doctor to write the next prescription. They need to experiment. They need to ask tough questions of the doctor. So, and I think experiment, when I say he found exercise useful, maybe someone else finds exercise useful. Another person finds changing sleep useful. I think that's very healthy.
But is that, I guess, that's sort of where the conversation has to start, right? I mean, how do you know which direction? So Chris suggested exercise or some sort of action. We heard from Kim, who had some sort of spiritual anchor. How do you go through that process of trying to figure your way out? And the second part of that question is, do you do it alone?
I don't think you do it alone. But I think that one significant problem with our disease model of depression, that depressions are meaningless, that they're just a neurochemical static, is that people don't actually analyze what's going on in their life and think about, do I need to make changes? Is this depression telling me something? And I don't think it's an easy process. I think maybe Chris makes it sound a little bit easier than it is. I mean, if it were easy to get out of a depression, then people would have done it. And depressions can go on for 6 months or a year or even longer than that, and it requires incredible strength and incredible patience. But I do believe that not only is there another side, the other side of depression, but people can actually emerge from depression stronger than they were before. But it is not going to be a simple, I wish I could promise a quick fix. I think that's part of the problem, that people have been promised quick fixes, and a lot of people have been disappointed with those.
And when you say people can emerge from depression stronger than what they were before, what do you mean by that? In what way?
A serious depression gives you perspective on everything that's ever happened to your life, in your life before. What's important? Who's important? What is meaningful to you? I agree with Chris to the extent when he says, you know, feeling follows action. So if you're moving towards things, you're doing things in your life that you feel are purposeful and important, generally speaking, you will start to feel better. And depression can be an opportunity to try and discover what those things are. But where I disagree with Chris is that I don't think it's easy. It's not like a eureka moment, and you can immediately discover what those things are. So I do recommend people have therapy if they're really distressed. I do recommend that they talk to family members and friends, but it's an active process.
Now, in the minute or so we have remaining, your video series, Let's Take Back Our National Conversation About Depression, how has it been going, and what sort of expectations do you have for it?
It's going very well. I'm delighted with the kind of feedback that I've gotten thus far. And my expectations are that this conversation is going to expand, that people in Wisconsin are going to hear this, and they're going to say, yes, I want to be a part of this. And I hope to talk with others in other states. And it's going to take time, but I do believe we can take back our national conversation about depression.
Well, Jonathan Rottenberg, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time. Jonathan Rottenberg has been with us for the past half hour or so. He's a research psychologist at the University of South Florida who started an online video series. It's titled, Let's Take Back Our National Conversation About Depression. As I mentioned before, we'll have his Facebook links and some of his videos and links to those on our Facebook page. Just look for Central Time on Facebook. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.